Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Chapter 25 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Handling the Law. Norton opened the door a trifle and called out, "One man at a time." There were some hoarse shouts from without, presumably from Dunleavy's friends. A chorus of derisive laughter from Allen's. Then the first man entered. It was Ace. The poet stood for an instant, blinking at the light. Then he grinned as his gaze rested on the occupants of the room. He was directed how to cast his ballot. He took the piece of paper that was given him by Norton, scrawled Allen across it, with a pencil that Norton had previously placed on the table, and dropped the paper into Dunleavy's hat. Hollis opened the rear door for him, but he halted on the threshold, looking back into the room with a broad grin. "God Almighty," he said in an awed tone, "there must have been a wad of money blown in this here town today. Drunks. Man alive, there ain't nothing but drunks. The town's reeling with 'em. They're laying in the street. There's a dozen in the silver dollar, and that many more in the fashion, and God knows how many more in the other saloons. Their heads is under the tables. They're hanging on the walls and clawing round in spittoons, gloriously, beautifully paralyzed." He was suddenly outside, pushed through the door by Hollis, and the door closed after him. Hollis glanced furtively at Dunleavy to see that gentleman scowl. He thought he saw a questioning glint in Allen's eyes as the latter looked suddenly at him, but he merely smiled and gave his attention to the next man, who was now entering. The latter proved to be Lemuel Train. He did his voting quietly and grimly, but as he went out through the door that Hollis opened for him, he growled, "Lordy, what a drunken bunch!" He looked at Hollis. "One of your men, too," he said, grinning slightly. "I thought you taught them better." Hollis frowned. He knew that Allen would need all his friends. None of them could be spared in this crisis. He smiled incredulously. It had been only a short time before that his men had accompanied him to the door of the sheriff's office. At that time they were perfectly sober. It would have been impossible for any of them. "And 10 spots a hummer when he gets started," Train was saying. "I've seen him before when he cut loose, and he sure is a holy terror." Then, with a word of parting, Train was gone, saying that he had done all the damage he could and that he proposed hitting the trail back to his ranch. He had certainly done some damage to Hollis. The latter's mind now rioted with all sorts of conjecture, and he mechanically did his work of letting man after man out through the rear door, scarcely seeing them. He was aware of an odd expression that had come into Dunleavy's eyes at the mention of Ten Spot. Had Dunleavy succeeded in bribing Ten Spot to desert him? He had left Ten Spot at the Circle Bar, not inviting him to Dry Bottom, because he felt that the latter would rather not come since he had deserted Dunleavy. And Ten Spot had come to town anyway. What did it mean? Did it mean that Ten Spot had come to assist Dunleavy in nominating Watkins and defeating his new employer? He frowned again, and for the next few minutes gravely studied Dunleavy's face. He was sure that the latter's manner had changed. The mocking smile which had been on his face since his arrival at the sheriff's office had been superseded by a huge grin, plainly of anticipation. Ten Spot, dangerous, reckless, drunk, at the head of a number of dissolute men, had it in his power to make things decidedly interesting should he advance on the sheriff's office with the intention of assisting Dunleavy. Several times since hiring Ten Spot, Hollis had doubted him. The suspicion had assailed him that perhaps the appearance of Ten Spot at the Hazelton cabin so opportunely had been a part of a plot by Dunlavey to place a spy in his employ. They might have purposely sacrificed Yuma. During the next quarter of an hour, he gave more attention to Dunlavey than to the steady stream of men that passed through the room, though he recognized a goodly number of his friends he had made during the latter days of the drought. Allen's spirits had risen during the last quarter of an hour. His maneuver had dissipated Dunlevy's strength, and it was plain to be seen that a majority of the votes cast were for him. If nothing unusual or unexpected happened within the next hour, or until 9 o'clock, the hour named in Watkins' proclamation for the closing of the polls, he was assured of victory. Thoughts of the same character were passing through Hollis's mind. There was silence in the office. A man was voting at the table, writing his favorite's name on a piece of paper. Hollis consulted his watch. It lacked over an hour of the time for closing. The man at the table finished writing and tossed the paper into the hat. Hollis opened the rear door to allow him to go out. While the door remained open, a sound floated in, which they all heard, an ear-splitting screech, followed instantly by a chorus of yells, a pistol report, more yells, and then a number of reports. Norton did not open the door. He exchanged glances with Hollis and Allen. Dunlavey grinned widely. "Something's coming," remarked Allen grimly. Dunlevy's grin grew derisive. "It would sure be too bad if my friends should bust up this peace meeting," he sneered. "There won't be nothing spoiled," grimly assured Allen, but he drew his other six-shooter. The sounds outside grew in volume as they swept towards the sheriff's office. They broke presently at the door, and an ominous silence succeeded. Then a voice reached the interior, harsh, authoritative, Ten Spot's voice. "Open up, you damn shorthorns," it said. Norton looked at Allen. The latter's face was pale. "They come in," he directed, "like the others, one at a time." Norton carefully withdrew the bar with which the door was fastened, swinging it open slightly. As he did so, there was a sudden rush of bodies. Norton tried to jam the door shut, failed, and was flung back several steps by the surging, yelling crowd that piled tumultuously into the room. There were perhaps 20 of them, and as they surged into the room, shouting and cursing and laughing, Hollis recognized among them many men that he had come to know by sight. They were of the reckless, lawless element upon which Dunlavey had relied for his support, men of Ten Spot's character. They had been drinking, but in spite of their laughter and loud talking, it was plain to be seen that they had determined not to be balked in the purpose which had brought them into the office. There was now no need to guard the door. The damage had been wrought, and Norton backed away, leaving the door ajar, pale, grim-eyed, alert, ready to take an active part in the trouble which he felt certain was sure to develop. Something in the faces of the men who had come in with Ten Spot proclaimed trouble. Allen had not moved. He still stood behind Dunlavey, but his weapons no longer menaced the Circle Cross manager. Their muzzles, level and forbidding, were covering the other men. Standing quietly beside the rear door, his face pale, his eyes bright, his lips in straight lines, Hollis watched closely as the visitors, having gained entrance, gathered together in the center of the room. They were not awed by Allen's weapons. They grinned hugely at him. One man, a young man of about Hollis's age, bronzed, lean, reckless of eye, and unmistakably under the influence of liquor, lunged forward to Allen and stood within arm's length of him, grinning at him. "Two guns," he said with a laugh. "Why, I reckon you'd make a hell of a sheriff." A chorus of laughter greeted the young cowboy's words. Dunlavey grinned widely. "You boys are just in time," he said. There was another roar of laughter. Many of the men seemed only now to have become aware of Dunleavy's presence, and they surged forward around him, disregarding Allen's guns. The latter seemed to realize that the situation had passed beyond his control, for catching Hollis's eye, he smiled grimly and sheathed his weapons, seeking Hollis's side. "It's no use," he said shortly to Hollis as he came near. "They'll run things to suit themselves now. I wasn't expecting Ten Spot to butt into the game." "I reckon they've got us." Norton had also sought Hollis's side, and the three stood near the rear door, watching the crowd around Dunleavy. Hollis tried to catch Ten Spot's gaze, but failed. The latter seemed studiously to avoid him. A wave of dull anger surged through Hollis's veins. Until now, the contest had been conducted fairly. They had given Dunleavy and Watkins an honest election, even though they had found it necessary to eliminate them as active participants. From now on, he was assured the contest would be a joke, though a grim one. He had depended upon Allen's success. It meant much to him. The thought of failure, just when victory was within his grasp, aroused him, and in spite of Norton's low word of caution, he stepped forward and stood beside the table on which reposed the hat into which the ballots had been placed by the men who had previously voted. He intended to take personal charge of the hat, determined upon securing a fair deal in spite of the great odds. As he stepped forward, he saw Greasy grin maliciously and try to snatch a gun from the holster of a cowboy who stood near him. This attempt was frustrated by the puncher, who suddenly dropped his hand to his holster, where it closed upon Greasy's. The puncher snarled, muttered profanely, and struck furiously at Greasy, knocking him down in a corner. Other men moved. There were curses, the flashing of metal as guns came out. Hollis felt rather than saw Norton and Allen advance toward the table and stand beside him. A grim smile wreathed his face over the knowledge that in the crowd there were at least two men upon whom he might depend to the end, whatever the end might be. He heard Dunleavy snarl an oath, saw his big form loom out of the crowd, saw one of his gigantic hands reach for the hat on the table. "I reckon I'll take charge of this now," he sneered, his brutal face close to Hollis's. Hollis would have struck that face that was so close to his, but at the instant he saw Dunleavy's hand reach out for the hat, he saw another hand dart out from the other side of the table, seize the hat, and draw it out of Dunleavy's reach. "I don't reckon that you'll take charge of her," said a voice. Hollis turned quickly. Over the table leaned Ten Spot, the captured hat in his hand, a big .45 in the other, a cold, evil glitter in his eyes as he looked up at Dunleavy. "I don't reckon that you're going to have a hand in running this show at all, Bill," he sneered. "Me and my friends come down here special to tend to that." He grinned the shallow, hard grin that marks the passing of a friendship and the dawn of a bitter hatred. "You see, Bill, me and my friends has got some sort of tired of the way you've been running things, and we're shuffling the cards for a new deal. This here tenderfoot, which you've been slandering shameful, is a man's size, and we're seeing that he gets a fair shake in this here. I reckon you get me." Hollis felt Norton poking him in the ribs, but he did not turn. He was too intent upon watching the two principal actors in the scene. Tragedy had been imminent. Comedy was slowly gaining the ascendancy. For at the expression that had come over Dunleavy's face, several of the men were grinning broadly. Were the stakes not so great, Hollis would have felt like smiling himself. Dunleavy seemed stunned. He stood erect, passing his hand over his forehead, as though half convinced that the scene were an illusion and that the movement of the hand would dispel it. Several times his lips moved, but no words came, and he turned, looking about at the men who were gathered around him, scanning their faces for signs that would tell him that they were not in sympathy with Ten Spot. but the faces that he looked upon wore mocking grins and sneers. "And I've been telling the boys how you set Yuma on Nellie Hazelton, and they've come to the conclusion that a guy which will play a low-down mean game like that on a woman ain't no fit guy to have no hand in any lawmaking." Ten Spot's voice fell coldly and metallically in the silence of the room. Slowly recovering from the shock, Dunleavy attempted a sneer, which gradually faded into a mirthless smile as Ten Spot continued, "And you ain't going to have a hand in any more lawmaking in this man's town. Me and my friends is going to see to that, and my boss, Mr. Hollis. I reckon that'll be about all. You don't need to hang around here while we do the rest of the voting. Watkins and Greasy can stay to see that everything goes on regular." He grinned wickedly as Dunleavy stiffened. "I reckon you know me, Bill. I ain't palavering none. You and Ten Spot is quits." He stepped back a little away from the table, his teeth showing in a mocking grin. Then he looked down at the hat, which he still held in his hand, Dunleavy's hat. He laughed. "Why, I'm certainly impolite," he said, insinuatingly. "Here you've been wanting to go, and I've been keeping your hat." He dumped the ballots upon the table and passed the hat to Dunleavy. Without a word, Dunleavy took it, jerking it savagely, placed it on his head, and strolled to the door, stepping down into the street. There was a short silence. Then Ten Spot turned and looked at Hollis, his face wreathed in a broad grin. "I reckon you all think you know something about handling the law," he said, "but your little Ten Spot ain't exactly the measliest card in the deck. We'll do our voting now." A quarter of an hour later, after Ten Spot and his friends had cast their ballots and Watkins had been forced to make out a certificate of nomination, which reposed safely in Ben Allen's inside pocket, the kerosene lights were extinguished and the men filed out. Hollis and Ten Spot were the last to leave. As they stood for a moment on the threshold of the doorway, Hollis seized Ten Spot's hand and gripped it heartily. "I want to thank you, my friend," he said earnestly. Ten Spot jerked his hand away. "Aw, hell," he said, as they sought the darkness of the street, "I ain't mushing none. But," he added, as a concession to his feelings, "I reckon to know a white man when I see one." End of chapter 25.
Chapter 26 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Autumn and the Gods. It was Sunday afternoon, and a hazy, golden, late September sun was swimming lazily in the blue arc of sky, flooding the lower gallery of the Circle Bar ranch house, but not reaching a secluded nook in which sat Hollis and Nellie Hazelton. Mrs. Norton was somewhere in the house, and Norton had gone down to the bunkhouse for a talk with the men. Hollis and Nellie could see him sitting on a bench in the shade of the eaves, the other men gathered about him. Below the broad level that stretched away from the ranch house sank the big basin, sweeping away to the mountains. Miles into the distance, the Circle Bar cattle could be seen, moving dots in the center of a great green bowl. To the right, Razorback Ridge loomed its bald crest upward, with no verdure saving the fringe of shrubbery at its base. To the left stretched a vast plain that met the distant horizon that stretched an interminable distance behind the cottonwood. Except for the moving dots, there was a total absence of life and movement in the big basin. It spread in its wide, gradual, downward slope, bathed in the yellow sunshine of the new, mellow season, peacefully slumberous, infinitely beautiful. Many times had Hollis sat in the gallery, watching it, his eyes glistening, his soul stirred to awe. Long since had he ceased regretting the glittering tinsel of the cities of his recollection. They seemed artificial, unreal.
When he had first gazed out over the basin, he had been oppressed with a sensation of uneasiness. Its vastness had appalled him. Its silence had aroused in him that vague disquiet which is akin to fear. But these emotions had passed. He still felt awed. He would always feel it. For it seemed that here he was looking upon a section of the world in its primitive state, that in forming this world the Creator had been in his noblest mood. So far did the lofty mountains, the wide sweeping valleys, the towering buttes, and the mighty canyons dwarf the flat hills and the puny shallows of the land he had known. But he was no longer appalled. Disquietude had been superseded by love. It all seemed to hold some mystery for him, an alluring, soul-stirring mystery. The tawny mountains, immutable guardians of the basin, whose peaks rose somberly in the twilight glow, did they hold it? Or was it hidden in the basin, in the great green sweep that basked in the eternal sunlight? Perhaps there was no mystery. Perhaps he felt merely the romance that would inevitably come to one who deeply appreciated the beauty of a land into which he had come so unwillingly. For romance was here. He turned his head slightly and looked at the girl who sat beside him. She also was looking out over the basin. Her eyes filled with a light that thrilled him. He studied her face long, noting the regular features, the slight tan, through which shone the dusky bloom of perfect health, the golden brown hair, with the wind-blown wisps straggling over her temples. He felt the unaccountable, indefinable something that told him of her inborn innocence and purity, qualities that he had worshipped ever since he had been old enough to know the difference between right and wrong. A deep respect moved him. A reverent smile wreathed his lips. Motherly? Yes, that world, thrilling word, aptly described her. As he continued to look at her, he realized that this world held no mystery for him beyond that which was enthroned in the heart of the girl who sat beside him, unconscious of his thoughts. He turned again toward the basin. He did not want to uncover the mystery yet. There were still several things to be done before he would feel free to speak the words that he had meditated upon for some weeks. Meanwhile, if the gods were with him, the solving of the mystery would be the more enjoyable. 2 weeks of inaction had followed the primary incident. Several of Ten Spot's friends were now in his employ. In spite of the drought, the Circle Bar had so far experienced a very prosperous season, and though the addition of these men represented quite an item of expense, he felt that it was much better to employ them than to allow them to be re-engaged by Dunleavy. He had been able to save considerable money. This he had transferred to a bank in Santa Fe, for he had determined to stay in the West. He had told his mother of this decision and had asked her to come, but she had written that she preferred to remain East for a time, at least until the following spring. Hollis was satisfied. Affairs were progressing beyond his anticipations. Dunleavy's influence in the county had received a mighty blow in the defeat of Watkins at the primary. He had received notice of the enactment of several new laws that would appreciably assist him in his fight. He had succeeded in winning many friends because of his attitude on the water question. The increased number of advertisements appearing in the Kicker would soon necessitate the addition of an extra sheet. It all presaged prosperity. Yes, he was satisfied, and yet... He turned again and looked at the girl. This time he caught her watching him. Evidently she had been watching him for a long time, for her gaze was fixed and meditative, as though she had been studying him. She started and blushed when he turned and caught her, looking down in sudden and complete confusion. But she looked up again instantly, meeting his gaze steadily, her lips in a frank smile. "You have been thinking of this country," she said. "You have guessed it," he returned, gravely and gently. "I have been thinking of this country and its people." He smiled at her, his eyes shining with a light
that caused hers to waver and droop. "But how did you discover that?" he questioned. "I was not aware that I had been speaking my thoughts." "Do you think it's always necessary to speak?" she answered, looking at him with a quiet smile. "Don't you think there are times when one's thoughts find expression in one's eyes, when we cannot conceal them, no matter how hard we try? I know that you were thinking of this country," she went on earnestly, "because a few moments ago I had been thinking of it too, and I know that my emotions were exactly the same as those expressed in your eyes." "It is magnificent, isn't it?" she said in an awed, eager voice. "It is so big, so mighty, so soul-stirring. It allures with its vastness. It dazzles with its beauty. It makes one feel closer to the Creator, even while pressing home a disquieting sense of one's own insignificance. For instance," she went on, her eyes large and luminous, a new quiet color coming into her face, "there are times when our tasks seem stupendous, when we are filled with an overpowering consciousness of the importance of them, when we feel that we are carrying such a burden that the addition of another would make the load too heavy. Then we look upon God's work, and immediately a still, small voice within us cries, 'What have ye done in comparison to this?'" "And what have we done?" she suddenly demanded. "Nothing," he returned gravely, awed by this fleeting, illuminating glimpse into her soul. She leaned back into her chair with a smile. "Those were the things I was thinking about. And you, too, were thinking of them," she added. "Now don't deny it," she warned, "for I saw it in your eyes." "No," he said with a quick smile, "I don't deny it, but I was thinking of the people also." "Oh, the people," she said with a frown. "Perhaps I should have said person," he modified, with a quick glance at her, under which her eyes drooped in swift confusion, as they had drooped on another occasion which he remembered. "Oh," she said merely. "I have been comparing this person to God's other works," he said, a light in his eyes, which told that the former decision to postpone an attempt to uncover the mystery had been ruthlessly put aside. "And I have come to the conclusion that in spite of the infinite care he took in forming the beautiful world out yonder, he did not neglect this person to whom I refer." Her eyes met his in a glance of swift comprehension. She drew a slow, deep breath and averted her face, which was now crimson. "As you have been able to illustrate man's insignificance in comparison to God's mighty creations, so has my own inferiority been forced upon me by my attempting to compare myself to the sweet character of the person of whom I speak," said Hollis, his voice low and earnest. "It has been a question whether, when I speak to her of a thing which has been on my mind for many days," she could not with justice paraphrase the question asked by the still, small voice and say, "What have you done to deserve this?" And I should have to reply, "Nothing." He had moved closer to her, leaning forward to look into her eyes. She sat very still, her gaze on the basin. "Perhaps this very estimable person holds other views," she returned, with a flash of mischief in her eyes. She turned suddenly and looked straight at him, meeting his gaze unwaveringly, a demure smile on her face. "I told you that sometimes a person's thoughts were expressed in their eyes," she said, and now her lashes flickered. "Perhaps you can tell what my thoughts are." It was a challenge, a defiance, and an unconditional surrender. Like a flash, one of Hollis's arms went out. She was drawn, vainly protesting, toward him. "You haven't answered," she laughed in a smothered voice. "You are not certain." She did not finish the sentence. Mrs. Norton, coming to the door for a breath of fresh air, halted on the threshold, looked, smiled, and then quietly, very quietly, slipped back into the house. Away out over the basin, a Mexican eagle circled, winging his slow way through the golden sunshine of the afternoon. Miles away, the mountain peaks rose somberly, a mysterious golden halo rising slowly above them.
Perhaps there would always be mystery in the mountains, but a certain mystery that had troubled Hollis mightily had been successfully solved. The gods had favored him. End of chapter 26.
Chapter 27 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain.
The Seer and Yellow Days.
"This here town," read a letter that Hollis received from Weary late in September, "ain't fit for no man to live in which thinks anything of himself. In the first place, there's too many folks here which don't seem to know what to do with themselves. They just keep milling around and acting like they was ready to stampede any time. In the second place, I'm running shy of dust, and I'd admire for to receive about a month's pay, which I won't charge to you, being as I've already spent more than I ought to. It's a good thing I got a return ticket, or I'd be in a hell of a fix when I got ready to come back. Last night the doctor at the hospital said he'd operate on Ed today, which he has already done this morning, and Ed's resting easy, though the doctor don't know whether he's going to get well or not. But he's hoping, and I'll let you know by telegraph if he gets any worse, which is all for this time. P.S. Say, boss, don't forget to hustle that coin. I'll sure make it right with you. I forgot to tell you that I got cleaned out by a card sharper here. I would have torn him apart, but about a million sheriffs piled onto me, and I didn't have no chance. What in hell does any town need with so many sheriffs? Weary. P.S. I'd like to be home for the roundup, but I reckon I won't make it. Weary. Nellie Hazelton did not see this letter. Though Hollis told her that Ed had been operated on, and that he was doing as well as could be expected. And the telegraph that night flashed Weary's coin to him. The days passed all too quickly now, for the time for the fall roundup was at hand, and Hollis realized with regret that his daily rides with Nellie Hazelton as a companion must soon be discontinued. The nights had already grown cool. Snow had appeared on the mountain peaks. The basin was no longer a great green bowl, but resembled a mammoth concave palette upon which nature had mixed her colors, yellow and gold and brown, with here and there a blotch of red and purple, a dash of green, lingering over the seasons, and great wide stretches of gray. The barren spots seemed to grow more barren, mocked by the scarlet blossoms of the cactus that seemed to be everlasting, and the fringing yellow soapweed, hardy, defying the advancing winter. Razorback Ridge was a desolate place, never attractive. It reared aloft barren and somber, frowning down upon its fringe of shrubbery, the latter stripped of its leaves, its scant beauty gone, bending its bare branches stubbornly to the early winds. With the last day of the month came a rain, a cold, bitter, driving storm that raged for 3 days, and started a drift that the cattlemen could not stop. Arrayed in tarpaulins, the cowboys went forth, suffering, cursing, laboring heroically to stem the tide. The cattle retreated steadily before the storm. No human agency could halt them. On the second day, Norton came into the Circle Bar ranch house, wet, disgusted, but fighting mad. "If this damn rain don't stop pretty soon," he told Hollis, as he dried himself before the open fireplace, "we'll have cattle down here from over the Colorado line, and then there'll be hell to pay." But on the third day the rain ceased and the sun came out. The country lay smiling in the sunshine, mellow, glistening, inviting. But the damage had been wrought. From Lemuel Train of the Pig Pen outfit came word that 50% of his cattle were missing. Truxton of the Diamond Dot, Henningsen of the Three Bar, and nearly all the other small owners reported losses. Of course the cattle would be recovered during the fall roundup, but they were now scattered and fair prey for cattle thieves, and with the roundup still 2 weeks away, It seemed that many must be stolen. Yet there was nothing that could be done. It is folly to attempt to cut out cattle on the open range. From the editorial columns of the Kicker might be gleaned the fact that the law had come into Union County. Many men of Dry Bottom entered the Kicker office to thank Hollis. Others boldly draped their houses with flags and bunting. Dunleavy had visited Dry Bottom twice since the incident of the primary. He had said nothing concerning the incident to anyone save possibly his intimates. But from the sneer that appeared on his face when approached by those whom he considered friendly to Hollis, it was plain that he intended continuing the fight. Hollis had been compelled to record in the Kicker the unpleasant news that Dunleavy had refused to comply with the new laws regulating brands and the submitting of lists for taxation, and also that he had threatened to shoot the first officer trespassed on his land. Dunleavy had not complied with the law, but he had failed to carry out his threat to shoot the first officer that trespassed on his land. For Allen had trespassed several times, openly and boldly. Moreover, Dunleavy had seen him, and even spoken to him, but had offered no violence. Perhaps in a calmer mood, Dunleavy had decided not to use his weapon. Perhaps there was something about the quiet, cool, and deliberate Allen which convinced Dunleavy that the former might be able to give a good account of himself in the event of trouble. At any rate, several times Allen had ridden the Circle Cross range unmolested by either Dunleavy or his men. He explored the farthest limits of the Circle Cross property, tallying the cattle, nosing around the corrals, examining brands, and doing sundry other things not calculated to allay Dunleavy's anger over this new and odd condition of affairs. Then one day he failed to visit the Circle Cross. Instead, he appeared to Potter in the office of the Kicker with a copy for a poster announcing the sale by auction of 1,000 of Dunleavy's best cattle. He ordered Potter to print it so that he might post copies throughout the county within a week. The night following the issue of the Kicker containing the announcement concerning the coming of the law, Potter had informed Hollis that he had that day delivered the notices to Allen. End of chapter 27. Chapter 28 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. In defiance of the law. Hollis had demonstrated the fact that a majority of Dry Bottom citizens welcomed the law. Dry Bottom had had a law, to be sure, the law of the six-shooter, with the cleverest man on the trigger as its chief advocate. Few men cared to appear before such a court with an argument against its jurisdiction. The law, as the citizens of Dry Bottom had seen it, was an institution which frowned upon such argument. Few men cared to risk an adverse decision of the established court to advocate laws which would come from civilized authority. They had remained silent against a day when it would come in spite of the element that had scoffed at it. And now that day had arrived. The law had come. Even the evil element knew it. The atmosphere was vibrant with suppressed excitement. In the stores, men and women were congregated. In the saloons rose a buzz of continuous conversation. On the street, men greeted one another with subdued voices or halted one another to discuss the phenomenon. In a dozen conspicuous places were posted flaring printed notices informing the reader that 1,000 of the Circle Cross cattle, a description of which followed, were, on the following day, to be sold to the highest bidder. Below this announcement, in small, neat print, was quoted the law. Dry Bottom gasped. The saloons swarmed. In the fashion, two bartenders and the proprietor labored heroically to supply their customers with the liquid stimulant which would nerve them to look upon Ben Allen's posters
with a certain degree of equanimity. The reckless element, the gunmen who in former days were wont to swagger forth with reckless disregard for the polite conventions, skulked in the background, sneering at this thing which had come to rob them of their power and which, they felt, presaged their ultimate downfall. But Dry Bottom ignored the gunmen, or smiled blandly at them, giving its attention to Ben Allen's posters, and discussing a rumor which had gained rapid credence to the effect that the new governor had telegraphed Allen that he would hold a detail of United States soldiers in readiness for any contingency. The good citizens smiled, and throughout the day many of them passed and repassed the Kicker office, anxious to get a glimpse of the man who had been instrumental in bringing about this innovation. Shortly after noon, on the same day, Dunleavy rode into Dry Bottom, dismounted, hitched his pony to the rail in front of the fashion, and entered. In former days, Dunleavy's appearance within the doors of the fashion was the signal for boisterous greetings. For here might always be found the law's chief advocates. Today, however, there were no greetings. Minds were filled with vague and picturesque conjecture concerning Dunleavy's probable actions and the outcome of this strange affair. Thus, upon Dunleavy's entrance, a silence, strange and awkward, fell in the barroom. There were short nods, and men fell away from Dunleavy as he crossed the room and came to a halt before one of Ben Allen's posters. He read every line of it, every word. No man interrupted him. Then, finishing his reading, he turned and faced the crowd, his face white with wrath, his lips snarling. "Why in hell didn't some of you damn fools tear this down?" he demanded. No man felt it incumbent upon him to reply to this, and Dunleavy watched them for an instant, sneering, his eyes glittering menacingly. Then he suddenly turned, seized the poster, savagely tore it into pieces, hurled the pieces to the floor, and stamped upon them. Then he turned again to the silent crowd, his face inflamed, his voice snapping with a bitter, venomous sarcasm. "Scared," he said, "scared out clean, like a bunch of coyotes running from the daylight." He made a strange sound with his lips, expressing his unutterable contempt for men so weakly constituted. "Quit," he grated, "quit clean because a tenderfoot comes out here and tries to run things. So long as things come your way, you're willing to stick it out. But when things go the other way, ugh." He turned abruptly, strolled out through the door, mounted his pony, and rode rapidly down the street. Several of the men who went to the door after his departure saw him riding furiously toward the Circle Cross. Then one of his former friends laughed harshly, sarcastically. "I reckon that there tenderfoot is bothering Big Bill a whole lot," he said, as he turned to the bar. It had been a busy day for Hollis. His hand had been shaken so much that it pained him. The day had been a rather warm one for the season, and so when late in the afternoon Norton rode into town to see the excitement, he told Hollis, the latter determined to make the return trip to the Circle Bar in the evening. Therefore, after a short conference with Judge Graney and Allen and a frugal though wholesome supper in the judge's rooms back of the courthouse, which Allen cooked, he and Norton rode out upon the Coyote Trail and jogged quietly toward the Circle Bar. There was a good moon, the air was invigorating, though slightly chill, and the trail lay clear and distinct before them, hard after the rain, ideal for riding. Many times during the first half hour of the ride, Norton looked furtively at his chief. Certain things that Mrs. Norton had told him had a prominent place in his thoughts, and mingling with these thoughts was the recollection of a conversation that he had held with Hollis one day when both of them had been riding the same trail and Hollis had stopped off at the Hazelton cabin. Many times Norton smiled. He would have liked to refer to that conversation, but hesitated for fear of seeming to meddle with that which did not concern him. He remembered the days of his own courtship, how jealously he had guarded his secret. But the longer his thoughts dwelt upon the incident that had been related to him by Mrs. Norton, the harder it became to keep silent. But he managed to repress his feelings for the first half hour, and then, moved by an internal mirth that simply would not be held in check longer, he cackled aloud. He saw Hollis shoot a quick glance at him. He cackled again, his mirth swelling as he caught the surprised and puzzled expression on Hollis's face. "I have a very original opinion of people who laugh without any visible cause," remarked the latter, grinning reluctantly in the semi-darkness. Norton's reply was another cackle. They rode in silence for a long time. Then Norton spoke. "This is a great country," he said. Silence from Hollis. Though taking a quick glance at him, Norton again observed the puzzled grin on his face. "An original," he remarked, placing upon the latter word the same peculiar emphasis that Hollis had given it a moment before. Hollis grinned widely. He began to detect a subtle meaning in the range boss's speech and actions, but he did not answer. It would not strain his patience to wait until such a time as Norton made his meaning clear. "But there's some things that ain't original," continued Norton in the same tone, after another short silence. This remark clearly required comment. Hollis grinned mildly. "Meaning what?" he questioned. Norton met his gaze gravely. "Meaning that the ways of making love are pretty much the same in every country." He laughed. "I know there's different ways of making it in books," he continued. "The folks which write books make their men and women go at it all kinds of ways. But did you ever know anyone in real life to make love to a girl any different than anyone else?"
"I have had no experience in lovemaking," returned Hollis, puzzled again. Norton cackled.
"No," he said, "and that's the peculiar part of it. Mostly, no one ever had any experience when they start to making love the first time. But they all make it the same way. That's why it ain't original. You take a man which has got in love with a girl, any man. He doesn't want anyone to know that he's in love with her. He feels sort of sheepish about it. Goes around hanging his head and blushing, and mostly not saying anything about it. Once he gets it into his system, he ain't the same man any more. Takes to acting reserve-like and gentle. But them that's had experience can see the symptoms. There ain't no way to hide it." Had Norton looked at Hollis now, he might have observed a touch of red in the young man's face, but he did not look. He was watching the trail ahead, smiling broadly. They had been riding through a deep depression, going toward a ridge whose crest was fringed with dense, tangled shrubbery. Hollis was about to reply to Norton's remark when he saw the latter's lips suddenly straighten, saw his body stiffen as he drew himself erect in the saddle and pulled his pony abruptly up. Surprised, Hollis also reined in and sat silent, looking at Norton. The latter's hand went to one of his ears, the fingers spreading out fan-like. "Listen," he warned sharply. Hollis had been listening. A low rumble greeted his ears. He looked suddenly upward at the sky, fearful that another storm, such as he had encountered months before, might be forming. But the sky was cloudless. He looked again at Norton. The latter's eyes shone brightly in the moonlight as he leaned toward Hollis. The rumbling had grown more distinct. "It ain't a stampede," said Norton rapidly. "There wouldn't be anything to stampede cattle on a night like this. And them's cattle." It was about 100 yards to the ridge toward which they had been riding, and Hollis saw Norton suddenly plunge the spurs into his pony's flanks, saw the animal rush forward. He gave his own animal the spurs and in an instant was at Norton's side, racing toward the ridge. The range boss dismounted at the bottom, swiftly threw the reins over his pony's head and running stealthily toward the crest.
Hollis followed him. When he reached Norton's side, the latter was flat on a rim rock at the edge of the little cliff, behind some gnarled brush. Below them, the country stretched away for miles, level, unbroken, basking in the moonlight. Hollis recognized the section as that through which he had traveled on the night he had been overtaken by the storm. The big level that led to Big Elk Crossing, where he had met Dunleavy and his men that night. Looking out upon the plain, he held his breath in amazement. During the time he had been at the Circle Bar, he had seen cattle running, but never had he seen them run like this. About a quarter of a mile from the ridge on which he and Norton stood, rose a dust cloud, moving swiftly. But ahead of the cloud, heads down, their horns tossing, were a number of cattle, perhaps 50, racing furiously. They were running parallel with the ridge and would probably pass it. Behind and flanking them raced several cowboys, silent, driving with their quirts. "Rustlers," came Norton's voice from beside him. "They're heading for Big Elk." Hollis had brought his rifle, which he had carried since the attack on the night of the storm. At Norton's word, he raised it. But Norton's hand touched his, and his voice came again, sharply, commandingly. "Don't shoot," he said. "It wouldn't do any good. Some of them would get away. Maybe they'll come close enough so's we can see who they are." Hollis waited breathlessly. It seemed that but an instant had passed from the time he had caught a first glimpse of them until they were thundering by the ridge and he and Norton were blinded by the dust. They had gone before the dust settled, but through it as they passed, Hollis had caught sight of a familiar figure. Before the thunder of hoofs had died away, Hollis felt Norton's hand on his arm and his voice in his ear. Dunleavy! There could be no doubt of that, for Hollis had recognized him also. He turned to hear Norton's dry voice in his ear. "The new law doesn't seem to be bothering Dunleavy a heap," he said. Hollis stepped boldly out on the ridge, his face grim and pale. But he was pulled back by Norton. "I take it you don't want to let them see you," he said. "When a thing like that comes off, there's always somebody sure to be looking back." He was pulling at Hollis's arm, directing his steps down the slope toward where they had left the horses. "You and me ain't enough," he was saying to Hollis. "We'll hit the breeze to the Circle Bar, get some of the boys, and hustle back here and take them cattle." Hollis accompanied him willingly as far as the horses. Then he halted, his eyes flashing brightly. "We won't go to the Circle Bar," he said. "We won't fight them like that. There is a law in this country now, and I'm going to see that the law acts." He seized Norton's arm in a firm, commanding grip. "You follow them," he directed. "From the edge of the butte where they caught me on the night of the storm, you can see the country for miles. Don't cross the river," he warned. "Stay there beside the butte until I come back. I won't be long. Watch where they take the cattle." Before Norton could offer a word of objection, he was on his pony and racing over the back trail at terrific speed. For a moment Norton watched him. Then he disappeared, and Norton grimly mounted his pony and rode down to the level, following the trail taken by the thieves. End of chapter 28.
Chapter 29 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Arm of the Law. The lights in Dry Bottom saloons were flickering brightly when Hollis rode down the street and dismounted from his drooping pony in front of the courthouse. He ran swiftly around the side of the building and knocked loudly on a door. There was a short silence, and then a movement inside, and Ben Allen stuck his head out of a window. He saw at a glance the upward-turned face of the nocturnal visitor and called shortly, "Wait, I'll be down."
There was a short wait, during which Hollis impatiently paced back and forth, and then Allen appeared in the door, fully dressed. Judge Graney, in a nightshirt, stood behind him.
"Something's up, of course," drawled Allen, as he stepped down from the door, "or you wouldn't come around disturbing folks this way. What is it?"
Hollis briefly related the events of the night, concluding with the statement that he was determined to force the law to act.
"Correct," laughed Allen. "She's got to act now." He caught Hollis's arm and turned him toward a small cottonwood grove about a half mile distant. A dozen white objects dotting the grove caught Hollis's gaze. He started.
"Soldiers?" he exclaimed.
"I might say that was a good guess," drawled Allen. "I sent for them because I thought I might need them if our friend Dunleavy got to cutting up any."
"It's been my experience that a detail of Uncle Sam's boys is about as good thing to have around in case of trouble as any man could want."
"But you can't use them in this case," remarked Judge Graney, who had stepped down beside the two men. "The governor's instructions were that they should be used merely as an instrument in enforcing the court's order regarding the sale of Dunleavy's cattle. The theft of the Circle Bar cattle is a matter which comes directly under the jurisdiction of the sheriff. If he refuses to act..."
"Hell," broke in Allen, "we know he won't do anything."
The judge smiled slightly. "I suspect he won't," he said dryly. He winked at Hollis.
"Being a judge in this district, I am, of course, averse to advising any infraction of the law. But if I were not a judge, I would suggest that two strong, energetic men, such as you appear to be..." He leaned forward and whispered in Allen's ear, whereat the gentleman let out a joyous whoop and almost dragged Hollis around the corner of the building toward the street, leaving the judge standing in the doorway. Once on the street, Allen set a pace that brought the two to the door of the sheriff's office quickly. A light shone through the window, and when Allen opened the door, Watkins was sitting beside his desk, gravely fumbling a deck of cards. He dropped them when he saw his visitors and made a quick movement with his right hand toward his revolver, but Allen's weapon was already out.
"Bill," he said in a soft, even voice, "we're wanting a warrant for the arrest of Bill Dunleavy. The charge is stealing cattle. Of course you'll issue it," he added insinuatingly.
Watkins' face slowly paled.
"Why," he began.
"Of course I knowed you wouldn't do it when I asked you," said Allen, with a dangerously soft smile. "That's why I come down here. This town's got a sheriff, and it ain't. I wouldn't care a damn if it didn't have you. There's lots of folks wouldn't care either. So that if you're one of them which does care, you're sitting right still and not saying anything which can be construed as talk till my friend here goes down to the station." He whispered to Hollis. "Be middling rapid," he said aloud afterward, "and use my name." He turned to Watkins with a smile. "While we're waiting, I'll do some talking," he said. "But if you let out one little wee chirp, them folks which don't care about you being sheriff of this man's town will sure have a heap of cause to rejoice." Hollis was already far down the street toward the station. When he got there, the station was dark. Evidently the agent had gone to bed. Hollis pounded heavily on the door, and presently the agent opened it, appearing in his nightshirt, a heavy six-shooter in hand, his eyes blinking.
"My name is Hollis," said the latter from the darkness. "I want you to telegraph the governor."
"Come in." The agent disappeared within, Hollis following. "This way," he directed, as he disappeared through another door leading into the station, his nightshirt flapping about his lean legs.
"What you wantin' to telegraph?" he questioned, as he seated himself before the instrument and looked up at Hollis. And then, before the latter could answer, he continued, "You're the darndest man to stir up a mess I ever seen in my life."
Hollis smiled grimly as he seized a blank and wrote his message to the governor. "Cattle thieves caught red-handed. Sheriff refuses to act. Crisis. Suggest you appoint me temporarily. Ben Allen." The agent took the message, read it, and then monotonously began to drum on the keys of his instrument. Hollis found it impossible to sit still, and so he nervously paced up and down the room during the sending of the message. The agent finished and leaned his head sleepily on the table. "Ought to answer in half an hour, if he's home," he informed Hollis, upon which Hollis slipped out of the door and returned down the street to the sheriff's office. Peering within, Watkins still sat at the table, and in a chair near him lounged Allen, talking volubly. Hollis watched for a time and then returned to the station to find the agent asleep beside his instrument. Hollis had scarcely awakened him when the sounder began its monotonous ticking. He leaned over the agent's shoulder and read the governor's answer as the agent sleepily wrote it down. "Ben Allen, you are hereby appointed sheriff of Union County in place of W. Watkins. Dismissed. Have judge certify." "I reckon there must be something going on," remarked the agent. "What's the matter with Bill?" But Hollis had snatched the message from his hand and was out into the street in an instant and running down toward the sheriff's office. When he arrived there, Allen was still talking. He passed a telegram to him, and the latter rose to his feet and smiled at Watkins, shoving the message under his nose. "You can read her," he said. "Then you can go home and quit sheriffing after I've got through with you. You've been called down to the courthouse. I'm taking you, charging you with being an accessory before the fact or something like that. It don't make no difference what it is. You're going with me." His voice came sharp and chill. "Jump." Judge Graney had dressed himself by the time the three arrived at the courthouse, and Watkins was roughly tumbled into the room which had been set aside as a jail. Then the judge led Hollis and Allen into the courtroom, where he issued Allen's certificate of appointment. "Now I reckon we won't have no trouble in getting the soldiers," he grinned. "This sheriff is going to act." End of chapter 29.
Chapter 30 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Forming a Friendship. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Hollis closed his desk and announced to Potter that he was going to the Circle Bar. Potter watched him with a fond smile as he went out the door and placed the saddle on his pony, mounted, and rode into the sunshine of the afternoon. The presence of the troopers in town had created a sensation, and most of the town's citizens were gathered about the courthouse, curiously watching Dunleavy and several of his men who had been taken into custody during the early hours of the morning. Neither Hollis nor Norton had been allowed to participate in the final scene, the little captain informing them curtly that the presence of civilians at what promised to be a free-for-all fight was strictly forbidden, and so Norton had returned to the Circle Bar, while Hollis had gone to Dry Bottom to finish an article for the next issue of the Kicker. It had been in that bald, gray time between darkness and dawn when Ben Allen and Hollis, riding at the head of the detail of troopers, beside the dapper little captain, had arrived at the edge of the butte where Hollis had directed Norton to await his coming. Norton's only comment upon seeing the troopers had been, "Where in the hell did they come from?" He told Allen that he had watched where Dunleavy and his men had driven the cattle, and that he would find them concealed in a narrow defile between two hills about a mile on the other side of the Rabbit Ear. He and Hollis had announced their intention to accompany the troops to the scene, but had been refused permission by the captain. The capture of the thieves had been quite a simple matter. In single file, the troopers had descended the slope of the river and crossed a shallow and clattered up the other side. A mile dash at a gallop had brought them to one end of the defile mentioned by Norton, and in a grove of fir balsam, the captain had deployed his troopers and swooped suddenly down into the defile, surprising several men who, with Dunleavy,
were busy at work altering the brands on the cattle they had stolen. There was a fire near the center of the defile, with branding irons scattered about it. The stolen cattle bore various brands. There were perhaps a dozen belonging to the Circle Bar, several from the Pig Pen. Others bore the brands of the Three Bar and the Diamond Dot. Proof of Dunleavy's guilt had been absolute. He had made some resistance, but had been quickly overpowered by Allen and the troopers. Then, with their prisoners, the troops had returned to Dry Bottom. Hollis rode slowly toward the Circle Bar. He was tired, dead tired. When he arrived at the Hazelton cabin, the shade on the porch looked so inviting that he dismounted and tied his pony to one of the slender porch columns, and seated himself, leaning wearily against the column to which he had tied his pony. He sat there long, staring at a clump of nondescript weed that fringed the edge of the arroyo near the cabin, his thoughts filled with pictures of incidents that had occurred to him during his stay in the West. Nellie Hazelton appeared in every one of these pictures, and therefore he smiled often. He had not liked the country when he had first come here. It had seemed to offer him no field for the pursuit of his ambition. Certainly, the raising of cattle had never entered into his scheme of things. Yet, he now realized that there was plenty of room in this country for success in this particular industry, and all a man had to do was to keep up his end until the law came. And now the law had come, and he had been partly responsible for its coming. The realization of this moved his lips into a grim smile. He filled and lighted his pipe, smoking placidly as he leaned against the slender column, his gaze shifting to a clump of dense shrubbery that skirted the trail within 20 feet of the cabin. He sat quiet, his long legs stretched out to enjoy the warmth of the sun that struck the corner of the porch floor. His pipe spluttered in depletion, and he raised himself and looked around for his pony, observing that the animal was contentedly browsing the tops of some weeds at the edge of the porch. Then, resigning himself to the sensation of languor that oppressed him, he knocked the ash from the pipe, filled it again, lighted it, and resumed his former reclining position. During the past few days, he had given much thought to Dunleavy. He was thinking of the man now, as his gaze went again to the clump of shrubbery that skirted the trail. Some men's mental processes were incomprehensible. Dunleavy was one of these men. What did the man hope to gain by defying the law? Would there not be profit enough in the cattle business when conducted honestly? He felt a certain contempt for the man, but mingled with it was a sort of grim pity. No doubt Dunleavy felt justified in his actions, for he had lived here a good many years, no doubt suffering the privations encountered by all pioneers, living a hard life, dealing heavy blows to his enemies, and receiving some himself. No doubt his philosophy of life had been of a peculiar sort practiced by the feudal barons of the old world, before civilization had come, carrying its banner of justice, which summed up epigrammatically, though ironically, had been might is right. But might could never be right in this country. Dunleavy must learn this lesson. He could not hope to. Hollis sat suddenly erect, putting aside his pipe and his ruminations at the same instant, the languor gone from him, his eyes narrowing coldly. For suddenly, from behind the shrubbery that skirted the edge of the trail, had appeared the man about whom he had been thinking. It was evident that he had not come upon Hollis unexpectedly. He reined in his pony and sat motionless in the saddle, his face white, his eyes alight with passion. For an instant neither man spoke. Hollis realized that the great moment for which he had waited many days had arrived, and it had arrived unexpectedly. It had arrived to find him tired after his activities of the night and in no condition for a fight. He drew a deep breath and got to his feet, a grim smile on his face. He stepped off the porch and stood by one of the columns, watching Dunlavey closely. As he watched, the grim smile on his face slowly faded. His lips curled bitterly, his eyes chilled.
"I suppose you've come to collect that thrashing," he said.
Dunlavey dismounted quickly. His right hand flew to his holster, drawing his revolver. He came toward Hollis, crouching, a cold, merciless glitter in his eyes.
"Yes, you tenderfoot," he snarled.
From the moment of Hollis's arrival at the courthouse the night before, Ben Allen had been constantly in action. It was late in the morning when he had returned to the courthouse with his prisoners. The men who had been captured with Dunlavey were still with the troopers, there not being sufficient room at the courthouse for them. Watkins had been released, and Dunlavey had taken his place in the little room that answered for a jail. Shortly before noon, Allen proceeded to the station, where he telegraphed the governor the story of the capture. He had then deputized a dozen punchers and sent them to the Circle Cross to round up 1,000 of Dunlavey's cattle and hold them until the late afternoon when, according to Allen's published program, they were to be sold to the highest bidder. Then, tired and hungry, Allen sought the Alhambra and ate a hearty meal. Dry Bottom was swarming with visitors that had come in for the sale. But by the time Allen had finished eating, the exodus had begun. The trail leading to the Circle Cross Ranch was dotted with probable bidders, curiosity seekers, idlers, and mere residents of the town. Now that the law had come, there were many who discovered that their sympathies had always been with the men who had championed it. Allen found his way to the courthouse, strewn with men who halted to express their goodwill. Many people gathered in front of the Kicker office, eager for a glimpse of Hollis. Those who gathered there before 12:30 saw him seated at his desk, tall, angular, and serious of face, absolutely unaffected by this thing which had caused a sensation. Passing the Kicker office on his way to the courthouse, Allen had paused to look within and shout a greeting to him. Then he had continued on his way. Arriving at the courthouse, Allen looked in at Dunlavey to find him lying on the floor, apparently asleep. Allen did not disturb him. He went out, threw the saddle on his pony, and rode over to the grove where the soldiers were quartered, talking long with the captain. About 2 o'clock, he returned to the courthouse to be greeted with the news that Dunlavey had escaped. Allen did not stop to inquire how the escape had been accomplished. He remounted his pony and raced down to the Kicker office, fearing that Dunlavey had gone there. Potter informed him that his chief had departed for the Sokol Bar fully an hour and a half before. He had taken the Coyote Trail. Potter had watched him. Allen wheeled his pony and returned to the courthouse. He was met at the door by Judge Graney. The latter's face was white and drawn with fear. "He's gone to kill Hollis," the judge told him through white set lips. "I heard him threaten Hollis this morning, and a moment ago a man told me that he had seen Dunlavey not over half an hour ago riding out the Coyote Trail at a dead run." Allen's own face whitened. He did not stop to answer, but drove the spurs deeply into his pony's flanks and rode furiously down the street toward a point near the Kicker office where he struck the trail. The distance to the Circle Bar Ranch was 10 miles, and Dunlavey had a good half-hour's start. He fairly lifted his pony over the first mile. Though realizing that he could not hope to arrive at the Circle Bar in time to prevent Dunlavey from carrying out his design to kill Hollis. No, he told himself as he rode, he could not prevent him from killing Hollis, should he catch the latter unprepared. But he promised himself that Dunlavey should not escape punishment for the deed. He had some hope that Dunlavey would accept his defeat philosophically. The latter was not the only man he had seen who had been defeated by the law. Over in Colfax County and up in Wyoming, he had dealt with many such men, and usually, after they had seen that the law was inevitable, they had resigned themselves to the new condition and had become pretty fair citizens.
He had imagined that Dunlavey would prove to be no exception, that after the first sting of defeat had been removed, he would meet his adversaries halfway in an effort to patch up their differences. The danger was in the time immediately following the realization of defeat. A man of Dunlavey's type was then usually desperate. So Allen communed with himself as he rode at a headlong pace down the Coyote Trail, risking his neck a dozen times. Not once since he had left Dry Bottom had he considered his own danger. He had been riding more than half an hour and was coming up out of a little gully when he came upon a riderless pony, and close by it, browsing near a clump of shrubbery, another. He recognized one of them instantly as Dunlavey's, and his teeth came together with a snap. He rode closer to the other pony, examining it. On one of its hips was a brand, the Circle Bar. Allen's face whitened again. He had arrived too late, but he would not be too late to wreak vengeance upon Dunlavey. He dismounted and cautiously approached the brush at the side of the trail. Parting it, he saw the roof of a cabin. He recognized it. He had passed it a number of times during his exploration of the country. He drew back and crept farther along in the brush, certain that he would presently see Dunlavey. But he had not gone very far when he heard voices, and he cautiously parted the brush again and peered through. He started back in surprise, an incredulous grin slowly appearing on his face. The incredulity changed to amusement a moment later when he heard Hollis's voice. The young man was seated on the edge of the porch, smoking a pipe. Near him, seated on a flat rock, his face horribly puffed out, with several ugly gashes disfiguring it, his eyes blackened, his clothing in tatters, one hand hanging limply by his side, the fingers crushed and bleeding, was Dunlavey. Near him, almost buried in the sand, was a revolver. Allen's smile broadened when he saw Dunlavey's empty holster. Evidently, he had met with a surprise. While taking in these details, Allen had not forgotten to listen to Hollis as the latter talked to Dunlavey. Apparently Hollis had about finished his talk, for his voice was singularly soft and even, and Dunlavey's almost comical air of dejection could not have settled over him in an instant. "And so, of course, I had to thrash you. You had it coming to you. You haven't been a man. You've acted like a sneak and a cur all through this business. You made a thrashing inevitable when you set Yuma on Nellie Hazelton. You'll have plenty of marks to remind you of the one you gave me that night." He pointed to his cheek. "I've got even for that, but I think I wouldn't have trimmed you quite so bad if you hadn't tried to shoot me a few minutes ago." He puffed silently at his pipe for a short time, during which Dunlavey sat on the rock and squinted pathetically at him. Then he resumed. "I heard people talk of damned fools, but never, until I met you, have I been unfortunate enough to come into personal contact with one. I should think that when you saw the soldiers had come, you would have surrendered decently. Perhaps you know by now that you can't fight the United States Army, and that you can't whip me. If you've got any sense left at all, you'll quit fighting now and try your best to be a good citizen." He smiled grimly as he rose from the porch and walked to where Dunlavey sat, standing over him and looking down at him. "Dunlavey," he said, extending his right hand to the beaten man, "let's call it quits. You've been terribly worked up, but you ought to be over it now. You ought to be able to see that it doesn't go. I've thrashed you pretty badly, but you and your men used me up pretty well that night, and so it's an even thing. Let's shake and be friends. If you show signs of wanting to be a man again, I'll withdraw the charge of cattle stealing which I have placed against you, and I imagine I won't have any trouble in inducing Allen to call off the auction sale and accept settlement of the claim against you." Until now, Dunlavey had avoided looking at the outstretched hand. But now he looked at it, took it, and held it for an instant, his bruised and swollen face taking on an expression of lugubrious self-pity. "I reckon I've got it in the neck all around," he said finally, "but I ain't no squealer, and I've got..." His gaze met Hollis's, and his eyes gleamed with a reluctant admiration. "By God, you're white! I reckon you could have tore the rest of me apart like you did my hand." He held up the injured member for inspection.
Allen's grin could grow no broader,
and now he showed his increased satisfaction with a subdued cackle. He backed stealthily out of the shrubbery, taking a final glance at the two men. He saw Hollis leading Dunlavey toward a small water hole at the rear of the cabin, saw him bathing Dunlavey's injured hand and binding it with his handkerchief. Then Allen proceeded to his pony, mounted, and departed for the courthouse to tell Judge Graney the news that kept his own face continually in a smile. End of chapter 30.
Chapter 31 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Afterward. From Razorback Ridge to Big Basin spread away to the Blue Peak Mountains. On the opposite side of the ridge began the big plain on which, snuggled behind some cottonwood trees, were the Circle Cross buildings. From where Hollis and Nellie Hazelton sat on the ridge, they could look miles down the Coyote Trail into Devil's Hollow, could see the two big cottonwood trees that stood beside Big Elk Crossing, above which, on the night of the storm, Hollis had been attacked by Dunlavey's men. Back on the stretch of plain above the basin, they could make out the Circle Bar buildings, lying close to the banks of the river. It was in the late afternoon, and the sun had gone down behind the Blue Peaks, though its last rays were just touching the crest of the ridge near Hollis and Nellie. He had called her attention to the sinking sun, telling her that it was time they started for the Circle Bar. "Wait," she said. "Someone is coming up the Coyote Trail. I have been watching him for 10 minutes. Hollis faced the trail and watched also. In a quarter of an hour, the horseman came out of Devil's Hollow. Hollis and Nellie could see him plainly as he guided his pony around the huge boulders that filled the place. Hollis smiled whimsically. "It's the poet," he told Nellie, catching her gaze and grinning widely at her. "I sent him to Dry Bottom this noon for the mail. Potter's going to stay in town overnight." For an instant it seemed that Ace would not see them, and Hollis rose from the rock on which he had been sitting and halloed to him. He responded with a shout and urged his pony up the steep side of the slope and then along the crest until he came within a few feet of where they sat. He dismounted and came forward, grinning broadly. Taken in the view, he questioned, his eyes twinkled. "Sometimes there's a heap of poetry could be got out of this country, but," and his eyelashes flickered slightly, "a fellow's got to be in the right frame of mind to get it out. I reckon you two..." "I suppose you got the mail," interrupted Hollis, grimacing at him. "I sure did," returned the poet. "One letter. I reckon the blacksmith will be kicking because I've been gallivanting around the country for one letter. Here it is." He passed an envelope to Hollis, and the latter, with a quick glance at the legend in the upper left-hand corner, tore it open and read. It was from Weary. "Dear boss, I got cleaned out again. What did you send me $100 for? You might have known that I'd make a gall darn fool of myself with so much coin. I never could keep no coin nohow. But it's all right anyway, 'cause me and Ed's coming home tomorrow. Ed's all right, except being a little weak, which the doc says he'll get over in a little while. Ta-ta, Weary. P.S. I might have telegraphed, but Ed says it don't make no difference, 'cause the letter will get there quick enough anyway, and he's afraid a telegram will scare someone. I'm damn glad I got a return ticket. Weary." After reading the letter, Hollis passed it over to Nellie, watching her, his eyes alight with satisfaction. "Oh," she said, "oh." The letter dropped from her hand,
was caught by the breezes and swirled several feet distant. Ace sprang to recover it. When he turned, the letter in hand, he saw something that brought a huge grin of sympathy to his face. But mingled with the sympathy was another emotion. "Boss," he said, as Hollis, disengaging himself, turned and faced him. "I've writ quite a nice little thing on love. Maybe you'd like to." He caught Hollis's frown and immediately retreated to his pony, his grin broadening as he went. He cackled with mirth as Hollis's voice reached him. "Ace," he said gravely, "don't attempt to write a poem on love until you've had some experience." "You're having yours now," insinuated Ace as he mounted his pony. He alone caught Hollis's reply. It was an expressive wink. End of chapter 31. Recording by Richard Kilmer, San Antonio, Texas. End of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer.